donated all his books to the Library of Congress for a reason. What if that's the home base for Operation Bloop? Horatio's our focus, Nola growled. Sig turned. Her face was red, her fists clenched. Silent Nola was no longer silent. Confused, Sig asked, "Don't you want to know what Blue Book is?" "I don't give a turd." "You give a turd. What I want are the people who put that plane down." "I got Houdini. So Horatio. Whoever he is, they murdered 7 people. They killed Camille. They were trying to kill me." Flicks of spit left Nola's lips as she said the words. Sig just stood there, at the foot of the twin beds, watching her catch her breath. In all the time they'd been together, she was an expert at being quiet. Now she was smoldering. Back at the insurance place, Sig convinced himself that when it came to killing Houdini, Nola had no choice. It was self-defense. Now, he wasn't so sure. "Nola, as you track this guy Horatio, when you finally find him, what are you planning to do to him?" Nola didn't answer. She didn't have to. Sig knew. Deep down, he always knew. For Nola, this wasn't about Operation Blue Book, or a government cover-up, or even the dead innocents on that plane. It was about revenge. "I'm telling you right now," Sig added, "whoever Horatio is, killing him won't solve anything." Nola was still silent, staring straight down at the reassembled gun in front of her. "And just so you know, I'm not helping you commit murder," Sig said. Still no response. Sig thought about calling the cops, or someone at the FBI. Maybe even Colonel Sue's commanding officer, the general in charge of Dover. But at his core, Sig was all too aware of this unarguable truth. Whoever he turned Nola over to, wherever they locked her up, her real name would eventually be put in the system. Once that happened, some bad folks who were looking for her would quickly find her. And once that happened, wherever Nola was being hidden, that wouldn't be a place she'd be walking away from. Ever. "If you have something to say, just say it, Mr. Zigarowski." "Why are you still here?" Sig blurted. Her dark eyes slid his way. "I mean it," he said. "I stopped your shoulder from bleeding. I patched you up. I even got you a sweatshirt from the lost and found at the front desk. It's a size too big, but if you put it on, it'll do the job. Every other time I've seen you, you leave as fast as you can. Even now, you could have darted outside and stolen my car, or just slipped away while I was cleaning the blood from your coat. But for some reason, you're still sitting here, staring down at your gun, which is out of bullets. So tell me, Nola, why are you still here, much less putting up with all my questions?" With a clench of her feet, Nola cracked her toe knuckles. "Because you're the one who can get me on that plane." Sig was confused. "What plane?" In her right hand, Nola picked up the notepad she'd been drawing in. She held it up, giving Sig his first good look at what she'd been sketching. The Sumto watch. Nola had drawn it over and over, each watch showing a digital time, a few letters, and a 10-digit number. "You did these by memory? Or did you copy them down?" Sig asked. She didn't answer, but as Sig looked closer, he could see that all the letters and numbers were different, each representing its own grid based on latitude and longitude. "You know where Horatio is, don't you?" Silent Nola didn't say a word. "Until. I need you to get me on that plane, Mr. Zigarowski." "Nola, this isn't please. Listen. I know where Horatio's hiding. I need you to get me to Alaska.
68. Homestead, Florida, 10 years ago. This was Nola when she was 16. It was the morning after she found the old letters. Royal was in the kitchen, flipping through a glossy magazine for high net worth individuals that Mr. Wesley had given him. Dream it to live it, and eating his peanut butter on toast. He was up early. On a Sunday. That was her first sign something was wrong. Nola kept her head down, cradling Dooch in her arms. At night, the skunk slept at her feet, even hesitantly followed her to the bathroom this morning, which brought Nola a silent thrill and sense of love she'd never experienced before. She tried focusing on that, hoping that maybe Royal would stay away.
"What do you want for breakfast?" Royal asked, a smile on his face.
That was her second sign. He was being nice. Wasn't licking his lips, either. Not drunk, not hungover. Whatever Royal was planning, whatever punishment was coming for Nola finding those letters, he was taking his time.
"Just, I guess, cereal, I guess?"
"Coming up."
Royal grabbed a box of Lucky Charms, poured it in a bowl, even took out the milk. He poured some for Nola and some for Dooch, who had leapt down from Nola's lap and was now walking in small but meaningful circles around the edges of the milk bowl.
"Mm-mm-mm,"
Royal said, squatting down and making kissy noises, trying to draw the skunk closer.
"That's for you. Drink up."
Dooch stayed where he was, by the milk bowl, cocking his head and adding a sour expression of judgment.
"So where are you going today?"
Royal asked Nola, his eyes still on the skunk.
"To a friend's."
Nola knew better than to tell Royal about Ms. Sable.
"She's got some toys and extra food for Dooch. A little cat bed, too."
"Oh, you want a cat bed?"
he baby-talked to the skunk.
"Go. Drink. Yummy,"
he added, motioning to the milk bowl. Dooch just stood there, not taking a sip.
"Maybe you want some cheese." "You want cheese?"
Royal said, reaching for the refrigerator.
"We should run,"
Nola interrupted, scooping up Dooch and heading for the door.
"Be back later."
Usually, Royal couldn't muster a goodbye. But today...
"Enjoy the sunshine,"
he announced.
"It's beautiful out."
He was right. Outside, the weather was gorgeous. The sky a pastel blue that reminded Nola of an iceberg. Deep down, though, Nola knew. She could feel it in her soul. No matter how much the sun was shining, a merciless storm was on its way. 69. Mitchellville, Maryland. Today. Nola told him she was hungry. That was all it took. She said she wanted a hamburger, and Zig was on it, headed for the door to get them some dinner. As Zig slid an arm into his jacket, Nola was sitting in bed, combing through the Twitter feeds of every Washington, D.C. news site, looking for mentions of the shooting, or of finding Houdini's body, back at Powell Insurance.
"Still nothing?"
Zig asked. Nola shook her head, still scrolling. They both knew what was happening. For a shooting to stay this quiet, it's because, yet again, someone high up was working to keep it quiet. "I'll keep looking," Nola said as Zig headed out. Yet as the door slammed behind him, Nola opened a new browser, typed in yellowpages.com, and clicked on the button marked Find People. From there, she entered a name she hadn't thought about in years. Lydia Konnikova, Ekron, Pennsylvania. An address and number quickly appeared on screen. Same address, Nola thought. No surprise. She clicked on the number. The phone rang 3 times before,
"Good evening, this is Lydia,"
a quiet and tired female voice said. "Mrs. Konnikova, this will sound awkward and I'm not sure if you remember me, but my name is Nola Brown. When I was little, you were one of our Girl Scout moms. I'm the one..." She was about to say who got the top of her ear cut off at the campfire.
"Nola Brown!"
Whose dad loved those Thin Mints?
Lydia sang, the life now back in her voice.
That's me, Nola said, remembering the fight Royal raised when, after he ate a dozen boxes of cookies, he found out how much each box cost. Naturally, he refused to pay, screaming at all involved until one of the moms paid for the Thin Mints herself just to shut him up.
How you been getting along, sweetie? Where are you getting along? My gosh, how long's it been?
The good news was, from the sound of it, Mrs. Konnikova hadn't heard that Nola was supposedly dead.
I'm sorry to bother you so late, ma'am, Nola said, ignoring the question. I'm just wondering if you can help me with something. I recently ran into Jim Zigarowski.
Ziggy? How's he doing? Where's he doing?
It was at a work event, ma'am, Nola said, now wondering if Mrs. Konnikova uttered anything other than questions. I hadn't seen him in over a decade. To my surprise, he remembered me right away. So as we were catching up, I asked him how his daughter Maggie was doing, and, well...
Oh, dear. You didn't know she passed, did you?
I didn't, ma'am. I felt horrible, of course. But later that night, when I tried to find out what happened, the records for the Ekron Eagle...
They weren't online back then, were they?
That's what I'm trying to say, ma'am.
Oh, dear. So you still don't know? No one told you?
I don't mean to pry. I just didn't know who else to call. Mrs. Konnikova let out a long, aching sigh.
You have to understand, this was back when Ziggy and Charmaine were still married. It was toward the end, of course, when the fighting got heated. In fact, now that I'm saying it, this was the real height of it all, screaming and yelling about...
She cut herself off. Nola made a mental note, knowing all too well why middle-aged couples scream at each other, especially before a divorce. Grabbing the notepad from the motel nightstand, she wrote the word, affair. She then crossed out the question mark. No shock, considering the last hoochie Zig was dating, who Nola found when she ran his phone records.
What I'm really getting at, Mrs. Konnikova added, is this wasn't a good night for the Zigarowski family. From what I understood, the shouting got so bad that... Well, 12-year-old girls don't like their parents screaming at full blast. So without telling anyone, young Maggie opened her bedroom window and snuck out.
Did Mr. Zigarowski know she ran away?
Not for hours. They had tucked her in, thought she was asleep. But at midnight, when they saw her bed empty, any parent would be panicked.
Nola cleared her throat, staring at the notepad, tempted to draw her old bedroom. She decided against it.
Anyway, when they realized Maggie was gone, all it did was take the fight to DEFCON 1. Maggie had run away before, during another night of arguing. She was such a good hider, it took Ziggy and Charmaine hours to find her. One time, she was nearly a mile away, hiding on some swing set in a neighbor's backyard. So you can imagine the scene on this night. They're both running through the house, calling Maggie's name. Charmaine's blaming Ziggy for yelling so loud. Ziggy's blaming Charmaine for the same. Then Ziggy, hoping to find her, he grabs his car keys, storming outside. He couldn't have any idea. You understand?
Mrs. Konnikova added, her voice slowing down, filling with dread.
He was just worried about his daughter, determined to track her down. So in a bolt of anger, Ziggy races out to the driveway and gets in his car.
Mrs. Konnikova's voice cracks as she says the words.
But what he couldn't possibly know is that on this night, young Maggie's hiding spot was underneath the car. She'd crawled under there for some quiet, and apparently had been out there so long, she fell asleep.
No, Nola whispered, not even realizing she said it out loud.
Ziggy couldn't have known. He couldn't have. He was upset in a mad panic, just a frantic father trying to find his missing daughter. So he gets into the car, throws it in reverse, and as he peels out of the driveway...
Nola's mouth gaped open, her pen hovering inches from the paper. Oh, God.
It was worse than you can imagine. According to Sheriff Acaro, Maggie was... She was... They declared her dead on the scene. I remember getting the call that night. We all went over the next morning with candles and flowers, everyone in the troop putting plush unicorns outside the house since Maggie always loved unicorns.
For a full 30 seconds, Nola just sat there, mouth still sagging open, replaying every conversation she'd had with Zig over the past 2 days, every thought she had about him, rewriting and recoloring it with this new information.
I haven't seen him for years now, Mrs. Konnikova finally said. How's he holding up?
This entire time, Nola thought he looked sad. Definitely lonely. But now, he's stronger than people think.
My gosh, I remember him as so handsome. Like a young Paul Newman with those eyes.
He still blames himself, though, Nola blurted.
Can you fault him? In one terrible night, his whole life disappeared. No wife, no daughter, he lost his parents years ago. The man went from everything to nothing. No one looking out for him, no one. Like they were erased. I mean, can you imagine?
Nola held the phone tight, not saying a word.
Plus, even if you can move forward after burying a child, which, let's be honest, is impossible, Mrs. Konnikova added. But even if you could, everyone knew Ziggy still blamed himself for all of it. For Maggie being under that car, for the fight that sent her there, even for his wife sleeping around on him.
His wife? Nola asked, eyeing the word affair on her notepad. I thought Zig was the one who had the affair.
Ziggy? No, that was Charmaine. She was sneaking off with an old high school flame. Some big-shot finance guy in Philadelphia. Unfinished business and all that. Jackie Siegel said she just heard they're finally getting married. But Ziggy? This planet doesn't make people as stubborn and stupidly loyal as that anymore. No, even back then when it came to his marriage, the only thing Zig did was kick himself for not seeing it coming. As a mortician here, he would get so absorbed in everyone else's losses, but there he was, completely missing his own. And then in one foul day, his life as he knew it was gone, Konnikova said. Truth is, I'm just happy to hear he's still standing. To live through what he lived through? Oh gosh, if I'm being honest, I worried he might have put a gun to his own head, you know?
Nola glanced down at the faded old marks on her wrist, and the wound in her shoulder, which Zig spent the better part of the evening stitching and sealing. I'm glad to report his life is finally calming down.
You think you'll see him again?
Nola looked at the door. Unclear.
Well, if you do, do me a favor. Give him a big, fat hug from all of us here. I remember that last night before he moved away. There was a going-away party, all of us hiding in the back 40 bar waiting to yell, "Surprise!" His old troop even baked a Samoa cookie cake, his favorite. Of course, Ziggy never came. Again, not that I blame him. These days, I just wish he could give himself some forgiveness. He's been through enough to earn that.
20 minutes from now, Zig would return to the motel room with 3 burgers for the two of them, plus some fries and onion rings.
Everything okay?
He'd ask. Nola would nod, barely looking up. Just hungry.
70. Zig couldn't sleep. No surprise. Even on a good night, in a good room, on a good bed, Zig could never sleep in a hotel. He'd stare at the ceiling, his thoughts wandering to what other celebrations and sins other ghosts had consummated there. Tonight, though, Zig wasn't staring at the ceiling. He was eyeing Nola, who was dead asleep in the twin bed on his right. She slept on her side, her weight on her shoulder, despite the aching pain she had to be feeling. Her face was calm, however, and Zig realized it was the only time he'd ever seen her with a placid expression. When Nola was awake, her brain was working. Only in sleep did she look untroubled. It made her look younger, like a child. At 1 a.m., Zig was still awake, watching the steady rise and fall of Nola's breathing, just like he used to when Maggie was little. And now he couldn't help but wonder if Nola was right. Clearly this wasn't just about a decade-old campfire. So was he really here just because he missed his dead daughter? Was he really that simplistic, that as long as Nola was around, it made him feel like a father again? If he were in his own house, lost in his own head like this, Zig would be in his backyard, studying his beehive, his ritual beer in his hand. Then he'd go on Facebook, checking on his ex-wife. Rituals were good things to have in life. Everyone needs something they can count on, especially when you feel like no one understands. Just a few feet away, Nola's chest rose and fell again with another steady breath. Some nights, Zig couldn't bear not seeing his daughter's face. Other nights, there was no pain greater than actually seeing it. A few feet away, perched on the nightstand, were the remnant wrappers from the burgers they had for dinner, and the new prepaid phone Zig bought at CVS. If he wanted, he could use it to go online, or at least get onto Facebook. Even without signing in, he could see his ex's profile photo and marital status. If someone was watching online, they couldn't trace him. With a quick look, maybe Zig would at least get some sleep. No, he told himself. Don't be so. Zig grabbed the modern-looking flip phone. With a flip, it was open and on. All he had to do was put his ex's name into Google. Her Facebook page was the third thing that came up. Zig glanced over at Nola. Her chest rose and fell. Snapping the phone shut, Zig slid it back across the nightstand. There you go. That's the right choice. He told himself it had nothing to do with Nola. He was just tired of being so damn predictable. 10 minutes from now, when he finally fell asleep, Zig would have an old dream that he hadn't had for years. A dream where he was driving his first car, an old Mercury Capri that smelled like wet fur, with his grandfather sitting in the back seat, telling dirty jokes. In just a few hours, he'd wake up feeling lighter than he'd felt in years, ready to take on anything. The feeling wouldn't last long.
71. Homestead, Florida, 10 years ago. This was Nola when she was 16. It was supposed to be a good night, or at least an easy night. It had been a while now since the letters, making Nola think that Royal had forgotten, or at least moved on. She was waiting by the front door as Dooch rubbed against the tufted leather ottoman like it was a conjugal visit. Months ago, Royal got pulled over by the police. He thought this was it. They'd finally tracked him down. His trunk was filled with printing supplies. They'd arrest him on the spot. But as the cop came to his window, the officer explained he'd simply been caught going 40 in a school zone. Right there, Royal said a thank you to God and decided to make a change. He would go back to sales, use his skills to build a business he could actually be proud of. He even had the product. One of Mr. Wesley's clients was a wholesaler of snacks and granola bars. Sell them in bulk to office break rooms and big businesses. If you're ambitious, there's real money. Royal saw it as his second chance. In his very last act, making fake IDs, he got the new ottoman by trading a social security card and a set of phone and electric bills to the owner of a furniture store in Tampa. Royal thought it made the living room look fancy, sophisticated. When potential clients came over, they needed to see that. But as Nola was keenly aware, it had been weeks since they'd seen any clients. Tonight, though, was different. Royal had nabbed the biggest fish of all. The supply sergeant for nearby Homestead Air Base had made an introduction to her superior. Royal had gone to the base to close the deal and, more important, collect the check. A big one. According to Royal, if things went right, maybe his biggest. Something to do with the Southern Command, covering every military base in Central America, South America, and the Caribbean, he'd told Nola last night.
You know how many granola bars they go through? This is change-your-life money, he'd added, as Nola took those words and imagined what they looked like.
A brand new life.
Maybe we move closer to the base, get our own pool, Royal had said.
So tonight, as Royal's car pulled into the driveway, Nola was standing by the front door eagerly awaiting his arrival. She didn't care about Royal or whatever dumb military deal he was chasing. God knows she didn't even care about the money. Sure, Royal had made a good living selling IDs over the years, but Nola never saw any of the cash. She was just excited for the Chinese food that Royal would be bringing home tonight, and the dry cleaning that always came with it.
That's how it always was when Royal got paid. For weeks, the dry cleaning would build up, too expensive to retrieve. But when Royal delivered on a big order of IDs and driver's licenses, and Mr. Wesley gave him his cash, Royal would return home with a big smile on his face, Chinese food in one hand and a fresh stack of plastic-covered dress shirts slung over his shoulder. All hail the conquering hero. On nights like that, Royal wasn't a better person, but he might let his viciousness go for a few hours. And on a night like this, his biggest deal ever, Nola wouldn't be surprised if he had bought the whole Chinese restaurant.
Dinner's here,
Nola teasingly whispered to Dooch as Royal kicked at the front door. Of course he was kicking. His hands were full with food and dry cleaning. Finally, Royal could get rid of Mr. Wesley and build a proper business.
Coming,
Nola called out. Dooch raised his tail at attention. Smiling hopefully, Nola undid the locks. But as the door swung open, there was Royal, empty-handed. A jolt of fear ran through her as she stepped out of the way. Trudging, his shoulders sagging, Royal didn't even look at her. It seemed he wasn't even angry. He was nothing. It was like someone had hollowed him out. No cash, no deal, no Chinese food, and certainly no changing your life. As Royal reached the couch, he took off his blazer and let it fall to the floor. Then he collapsed into the cushions, his torso hunched like the letter C. Dooch leapt up next to him. For a moment, the way his body jerked as he breathed in, Nola thought Royal was about to cry, but he didn't. Throughout her years with him, especially during his early days in sales, Nola had seen Royal make deals, close deals, and lose deals, but she'd never seen him. She searched for the word, defeated.
I can make dinner,
Nola finally said. By now, she'd made peace with the fact that he took her in all those years ago, so he'd have someone to cook and clean for him. Then, for a reason she couldn't explain, she decided to join him on the couch. She didn't get close. She just sat there on the other side of him, so Royal was between her and Dooch. The three of them sat there for a while, Nola searching for something else to say. Finally, he spoke.
Yeah,
he mumbled. Go make dinner.
72. Dover, Delaware. Today. First, he'd need to hide her. Zig knew where. It was barely 5 a.m., the sky still an inkwell. They'd left the motel hours ago, Nola lying down in the back seat as they weaved toward Dover's downtown historic district, not far from the courthouse. At this hour, the quaint narrow streets were empty. Even Tiffany's Bakery wasn't open yet. You sure there's no alarm? Nola asked as they reached their destination. No alarm, Zig insisted, sneaking through the side yard of a grand 1918 white-clabbered home. With its laid-back front porch and antique carriage lights, it was the kind of house you see in a movie, a romantic comedy where the characters live in a place that you know they couldn't afford in the real world. But you don't care, because you'd love to live there yourself. Nola stared at the house, cocking her head to the side. But in the past few hours, Zig had become better at reading her. She didn't like this place. Don't worry. We'll be quick, Zig said as he reached the old garage in back. It had vintage swinging wood doors. This is what we came for? Nola asked. Now Zig was the silent one, grabbing the padlock on the garage doors and pulling out a key. Nola glanced back at the house, giving it one of her good long stares. Every window was dark. There's no way she knew what she was walking into. No one lives here, do they? Zig turned. How do you... He shook his head, knowing better than to ask. With a twist of the key, the padlock popped and Zig tugged open the garage doors, revealing the back of a shiny black car that at first looked like a station wagon. But as the moonlight hit it... A hearse? Nola asked. How do you know no one lives here? The place smells like death. Turning back toward the beautiful old house, she added, It's a funeral home, isn't it? One of Delaware's oldest. There's a sign on the other side of the house. When they're busy, I pirate here. Pirate? Sorry, when there's a big disaster, like a traffic accident with multiple deaths, a local funeral home will get so overwhelmed, they can't handle all the bodies. So they'll call in a pirate, Zig explained, using the nickname for roving embalmers. When Zig first started in the industry, it's how he got experience, floating from funeral home to funeral home, community to community. The joke is, when you pirate around, you're kinda like Death himself. Nola stared at him. I always thought Death was a she. Zig let that one sink in. Anyway, when it's winter in the Middle East, fighting season winds down, so there are fewer casualties among our troops. When Dover gets quiet, I'll sometimes add a few hours and moonlight here after work. Nola turned back to the garage. Tell me why we need a hearse. You said Horatio's in Alaska. I checked the schedule. The flight that brought the bodies to Dover is finally headed back. If you want to be on it, we have to first get you on base. Dover won't stop a hearse? Of course they'll stop a hearse. It's a military base. They stop everything. Scan your IDs, mirror under the car, pop the trunk. But even when they search the trunk, there's one place they'll never check. Inside the garage, Zig pulled the string for an overhead light. In front of the hearse, up on a rolling church cart, was a 7-foot-long box, shiny cherry veneer, antique bronze hardware. A casket. Nola looked like she was about to take a half step back, but she stood her ground. All you have to do is lay there, Zig said, raising the casket's head panel and pointing inside. Cream velvet interior. Nola studied the coffin for a solid 10 seconds. Her lips were pressed together in a thin, flat line. As always, she had that blazing focus, like her eyes were microscopes, able to see down to the molecular level. Nola, if you don't want to do this, I can do it. Committing to the cause, she climbed inside the coffin and leaned back into resting position, as if she'd done it before. Shut the lid, Mr. Zigarowski. I'm not missing that plane. 73. Dover Air Force Base, Delaware. They found a what? A finger, Zig said. He kept his voice low, like he was sharing a secret. Plus, someone's femur. Out on the runway, the young staff sergeant with cropped black hair and a triangular nose made a face. He was barely 30. Easily fooled. That's what happens in a plane crash, Zig added, his voice still quiet. With a glance over his shoulder, he checked for the fourth time that they were alone. It was almost 6 a.m., the sky starting to blink awake. Like any military base, Dover was up early. But not this early. As far as he could tell, there was still no one watching. During search and recovery, we'll be finding portions of people for days. The staff sergeant looked at the 3 metal transfer cases sitting there, each on its own industrial rolling cart. If they had been transporting fallen service members, the cases would be packed with ice and covered with American flags. These 3 were uncovered, looking like long silver coffins shining in the morning sun. I don't know how you do it every day, the staff sergeant said. His name tag said Kiesel. But I appreciate that you do. Then maybe you can help me get these on board, Zig asked, tugging on the metal cart and steering one of the metal transfer cases across the asphalt runway. He didn't like hiding Nola like this, but 40 minutes ago, as he rolled her out of the hearse and into the mortuary building, and then switched her from the casket into one of these metal shipping cases, he knew it was the only way to pull this off. 50 yards ahead, a mammoth C-17 transport plane was on the flight line, its back loading ramp wide open, awaiting its last few items. The 4 fans weren't spinning yet, but its engines were prepping, making a loud drilling sound. Here, you need these, Kiesel said, reaching into his pocket and handing Zig what the Army called hearing protection, a $2 set of bright orange earplugs. As Zig put them in with one hand, he used his other to wrap his knuckles against the head of the metal case, right where he drilled the air holes. A single tap, loud enough that there was no missing it. Simple code. Almost on the plane. Zig knew Nola was too smart to tap back. Not until she was sure they were alone. So you think there are more bodies in Alaska? Kiesel called out, grabbing the other two rolling carts and giving them a tug. He was used to the job. As a loadmaster, he was in charge of the plane's cargo. We'll certainly find out, Zig said, leading the way and checking over his shoulder for a fifth time. He scanned every window in every nearby building. On the second floor of the mortuary, a light popped on. Dr. Sinclair in the ME's office was setting his morning tea on his desk. Even if Sinclair looked outside, there was nothing out of the ordinary, at least for Dover. 2 days ago, Kiesel and his crew flew the bodies here from Alaska. Today he'd be making the return trip, the plane restocked with empty transfer cases for when the next disaster hit. For mass fatalities or something like a plane crash, a mortician would also be sent to the crash site to help with recovery and cleanup. A detail Zig took full advantage of first thing this morning, when he switched with a co-worker to be on this outbound flight. To keep anyone from finding out, he didn't even put it in the system. Stay out of sight. Don't let them know you're coming. The only question was, could he do the same for Nola? There was a metal cha-chink as the wheels of the rolling cart hit the base of the plane's ramp. Here, let me help, Kiesel called out. The cases are light. We can just carry them on I'm fine, Zig insisted, shoving the rolling cart and pushing it, and the metal case up the ramp. The thick wheels on the cart were able to hold 600 pounds. This should be an easy climb, if the casket were empty. Zig stared down at the aluminum case. Even as it rolled, it barely rattled at all. You okay? Kiesel called out. Fine. Tweaked my back a few weeks ago, Zig said, faking a grin and taking a sixth scan of the building behind them. There was another cha-chink as they reached the top of the ramp. Inside the plane, the cargo hold was pretty much bare. If a general was scheduled to be on board, they'd roll in a pallet with a fully functioning executive office, complete with desks, couches, and a fancy bathroom. If there were loads of passengers, they'd add a pallet filled with airline-type seats. Today, though, at the back of the cargo hold were two large supply crates strapped into place. The rest of the open space was empty, except for three other metal transfer cases lined up side by side, their toes facing Zig in meticulous formation. There should be straps, I see 'em, Zig said, eyeing the black nylon straps that would hold the case in place. Inside the cargo hold, the humming of the engines echoed even louder. In one quick movement, Zig turned the push cart around, lowered it to the ground, and gave a tug to the handles on the aluminum transfer case. Six metal rollers sent the case sliding toward him. Momentum let it skid across the floor and roll into place, so that the head of Zig's transfer case was perfectly in line with the foot of the case already on the plane. Outside the back of the plane, at the mortuary, another light went on in another window. The blinds were closed, but Zig knew that room. Colonel Sue. If she found out what Zig was up to... Don't think about it. Just keep moving. Get to takeoff, Zig told himself, quickly ratcheting and strapping Nola's case to the metal floor so it'd stay put during the ride. Next to him, Kiesel was doing the same, lost in his work. Seeing Kiesel distracted, Zig again gave a quick knock-knock to the metal case. Two taps this time. On the plane. Need some assistance? Zig offered, turning his attention back to Kiesel, who was already working on the third case. With a hard tug of the nylon straps, they ratcheted it in place and locked it to the floor. Outside the back of the plane, two more lights went on in the mortuary. Time to get this moving. What else you need? Zig asked, purposefully stepping a bit too close into Kiesel's personal space. Actually, I should get upstairs, Kiesel said, heading for the ladder that led up to the cockpit. Despite the mammoth size of the plane, the flight had a tiny crew. Pilot, co-pilot, and Kiesel, the loadmaster, who stopped at a large wall panel of knobs and switches. He pushed a button, and with a mechanical whir, the loading ramp slowly closed, swallowing the morning sun from outside. Zig's eyes were still on the mortuary, which seemed to shrink as the back door shut. The interior went dark. Fluorescent lights popped on. 10 minutes until takeoff, Kiesel said as the plane began to rumble. The first of four engines started to spin up to full speed. "Sorry I can't offer you a better seat," Kiesel added, pointing to the fold-down jump seats along the wall of the hull. "Our pilot's a stickler, but once we hit 10,000 feet and level off, I'll get you up in the cockpit." As Kiesel disappeared upstairs, Zig pretended to sort through his own belongings, including the oversized army duffel he'd brought onto the plane earlier and strapped to the metal rings on the floor. Inside was Zig's winter coat, plenty of layers, plus his full mortician kit, including baggies, modeling clay, makeup, and of course, scalpels and tools. He also had a guidebook on their actual destination, Alaska's Wrangell St. Elias Park and Preserve, not far from where the original plane went down, and all of this started. Zig already knew the park was enormous, the largest national park in the entire country. But according to the guidebook, it was also one of the least explored, which begged the one question Zig still couldn't answer. What was the government really doing out in the Alaskan wilderness? From what Nola said, and what Zig learned at the magic shop, Houdini's specialty was moving money. More specifically, money that was used to pay off innocents when the government accidentally plowed through their lives. So was that what happened in Alaska? A disaster took place during Operation Blue Book. Or was Blue Book itself the disaster? Whatever the case, according to Nola, only one person had the answer. The person who was pulling the strings from the start. Horatio. Outside, the second engine churned to life, its fan now spinning. Wouldn't be long now. Sitting in the jump seat and pretending to flip through his guidebook, Zig opened to a page that featured the rare fauna of Alaska, including a tiny blue flower that was so poisonous it could kill a humpback whale. Upstairs, there was a loud metal clank, the cockpit door slamming shut. Kiesel was finally inside. Racing across the hall, Zig slid down on his knees, nearly slamming into the farthest transfer case on his left. He gave the metal top three quick taps with his knuckles, their final code. All clear. Zig waited for a response. Nothing. He tapped the case again. Three taps. All clear. Tap back that you understand. Still nothing.
Nola, can you hear me? Tap back if you hear me,
Zig whispered, his mouth up against the casket's air holes. Once again, nothing but silence. Zig's brain quickly calculating just how little air was inside. The air holes he drilled were big enough, weren't they?
74. Homestead, Florida. 10 years ago. This was Nola when she was 16. He threw the letters at her head, the whole stack of them. It happened midway into one of Royal's rages, one that ignited when he blamed Nola for a flat tire caused by a broken bottle of scotch in their driveway. Never mind that the bottle was left there by Royal.
You should know to clean it up. That's your job, nigger,
Royal screamed. It had been barely a week since Royal lost the military granola bar deal. He was back to making IDs and fake paperwork for Mr. Wesley. Nola was down on her knees, garbage bag in hand as she picked up shards of glass from the driveway.
You know what this cost me. That was my spare. Whap!
She didn't even see where the letters came from. Royal reached into the car. Was he hiding them in the glove box? And next thing she knew, with Royal in mid-rant, his rage peaking, the full stack hit Nola in the back of the head. Ancient letters from Barb LaPointe scattering along the asphalt.
Don't you dare pick 'em up!
Royal roared, awkwardly trying to kick the letters down the driveway, most of them going nowhere. At the sight of it, Nola almost laughed. She didn't, though. Not after what he did last time he thought she laughed at him. Still, seeing the old letters, an odd relief ran over her. She knew he'd make her pay for finding the letters. At least the waiting was over.
You think you can go through my stuff? You think you can steal from me like that?
I didn't steal, Nola thought to herself.
Don't look at me like that. You got something to say?
Nola stared straight down, picking glass from the driveway, knowing better than to answer.
You know how much money you cost me? When those thieves, the LaPointes, when I took you in, that wasn't a party. I was trying my fucking best, but it cost money. Everything costs money. Class costs money. Don't I teach you that? He shouted, working himself up to the next level of rage. A bonus level, where he was yelling so loud his voice went hoarse and his nostrils went wide. The grid of veins below his eyes was now showing. Nolan knew what came next. Hoping to buy some time, she picked up the final shards from the driveway, a web of glass held together by the scotch label, and tossed it into the trash.
Let's go. Now!
Royal growled, yanking her by the back of her neck, shoving her toward the side of the house to the backyard. At the center of the yard, Royal unleashed a violent kick on the upside-down kiddie pool, sending it sliding across the green grass, wobbling like a 1950s flying saucer and revealing the hole that Nola had been digging since they first moved here.
Half hour, no stopping,
he said with a final shove, sending her crashing to her knees into the damp dirt.
No breaks either.
At the bottom of the hole was a shovel. A new one, actually, since Nola threw the old one away, pretending it was stolen. Royal borrowed this one from a neighbor, Nola knowing he'd never give it back.
What are you waiting for?
Royal added, even though she was already climbing into the hole, which was as long as a coffin. It was deep now, too, up to her thighs, and would have been even deeper if the frequent Florida rain didn't backfill at least half of it with each downpour. Royal didn't care.
When you dig yourself into a hole, you dig yourself out.
For the next half hour, Nola did just that, shovelful by shovelful. She wasn't 8 anymore. She'd just turned 16. Each scoop of dirt was hard, but it wasn't impossible. Her hands had calloused long ago as muscle memory handled the rest. Dig and throw. Dig and throw. Dig and throw. 20 minutes in, she'd barely slowed down. It's not that she wasn't tired. Beads of sweat high-dived from her nose. But over her shoulder, she could feel Royal watching from the house. She wouldn't give him the satisfaction. Dig and throw. Dig and throw. Dig and throw. 25 minutes in, the sky was getting dark and the moon was out. A half moon. Nola wouldn't look up at it. Ever since Royal gave her the moon as a present, she hated it. By the last few shovelfuls, sprinkles of dirt were scattered across the back of her neck, in her hair, on her arms. She was covered, but finally finished. She looked back at the house. Royal was gone. Tossing the shovel like a javelin into the ground, she actually felt good. In fact, as adrenaline flooded her brain, it made her wonder if, despite Royal's assholiness, he might actually be onto something. After so much digging, her anger was gone, or if not gone, at least muted. She remembered that, taking it with her always. Heading back to the house, she saw the kitchen lights were on. Royal had grabbed a soda. TV flickered from the living room. He was now medicating himself with sports highlights, waiting for her to make dinner. She took it as a good sign. He didn't like anything interfering with dinner. Indeed, as the back screen door snapped shut behind her, the one thought in Nola's brain was that maybe tonight might even be a quiet night. She couldn't have been more wrong. She stopped mid-step, seeing the shadow on the orange linoleum floor that was supposed to look like terracotta tile.
Dooch?
At the center of the kitchen, her skunk was lying there, flat on his side. His four legs were awkwardly extended like he was sleeping, but he always slept curled up in a ball.
Dooch?
Nola whispered, the dark feeling already tightening in her chest. The skunk didn't move.
Dooch? You okay?
She added, smacking her palms together in a single loud clap, hoping to startle him. Even before the sound hit, she knew the answer. The skunk didn't react to the sound. Didn't move. He just lay there, frozen on his side, with a weight Nola had never seen before but instantly recognized.
No, 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 no!
Nola pleaded,
sliding to her knees, fresh dirt raining off her as she scooped the lifeless skunk into her arms. His body was stiff. The stiffness caught her off guard and she dropped him. He bounced awkwardly against the linoleum, his eyes still open, pupils wide and dilated. She didn't care. She scooped him up again, holding him to her chest, embracing him and knowing this lifeless thing in her arms. It wasn't her pet anymore. It was just a thing. And she hated herself for thinking that.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry,
she whispered, down on her knees, rocking back and forth, cradling Dooch's body. In the corner, his food bowl held a few crumbs. He'd just finished eating. Nola didn't cry. She kept that promise. There was a moment where she thought the tears would come, but it passed too fast, punctured by a far more powerful feeling. A swell of anger, of hatred, real hatred, that crept up from her belly, invading her on a molecular level. There was a noise on her left. She turned. Royal was standing there like he'd been there all along, arms crossed at his chest, soda in his hand, on the threshold of the kitchen.
My God, what happened? He asked.
The world went red. At just the sight of him, Nola could feel something hardening inside her, could feel something elemental rising.
Is Dooch okay?
He added. On most days, Nola's specialty was finding the hidden things, the lies we hide every day. But here, in this kitchen, as she cradled her dead pet in her arms, Royal wasn't hiding anything. It was right there on his face. He had a fire behind his eyes, and an unmistakable grin.
Nola, I feel awful for you. Is there anything I can do?
She wanted to fight. Wanted to rush at him, wanted to lace her fingers around his throat and squeeze tight until her nails pierced his windpipe and his life was gone, and he was the one who was just a stiff, empty, lifeless thing. But she knew what would happen in a fight like that. Today was proof of it. She wasn't fighting a man. Royal was an animal.
God, just heartbreaking, right?
Royal asked.
The world isn't perfect. Why do folks think it is?
She didn't respond. Years from now, an army psychologist would make a note in Nola's file saying she suffered from RAD, reactive attachment disorder, which happens when a child can't form attachments because of early neglect. But tonight, silent Nola just sat there, down on her knees, cursing herself for thinking she could have anything good. And cursing herself even more for taking the pet near Royal in the first place. If she hadn't taken him home, he'd still be alive. Lesson learned. She'd never bring anything she loved near the house again.
75. Dover Air Force Base, Delaware. Today.
Nola, we're on board. All clear.
Sig whisper hissed, leaning down to the casket's air holes. He pulled out his earplugs so he wouldn't miss her response. Outside, there was another loud whir. The third engine began its high-pitched whine. One more until full power.
Nola, you hear me?
Sig added, now louder, his mouth up against the air holes.
You okay?
Final check, Kiesel called out on the PA system. 2 minutes to take off.
Silent, Nola. That's her M.O. Always silent, Sig told himself.
He thought again about the air holes. They had to be big enough. Right? Behind him, Sig heard a noise by the stairs. Kiesel was coming. Racing back toward the jump seat, Sig grabbed the Alaska guidebook, pretending to read.
Make sure to strap in, Kiesel shouted over the noise, hopping off the bottom step for his final inspection.
Sig fastened his safety belt, still studying Nola's metal case.
She's fine,
he insisted, reminding himself that there's enough air in a coffin for at least 4.5 hours of breathing. Kiesel made a quick loop through the hull, checking every light, every gauge, every switch, every cargo strap, plus the anchor line cable that ran down from the ceiling. Diagonally across from Sig, toward the back of the plane, He noticed the side door with the red and green lights above it. Emergency exit. Wide enough for a casket. Sig didn't even want to think about it. She's fine. There was a final loud whir as the fourth and final engine began to whine. See you at 10,000 feet, Kiesel called out, closing the door and heading back upstairs. The moment Sig was alone, he raced back to the case. Forget the stupid codes. He banged hard on the metal top. Come on, Nola. Give me a response. He put his ear to the case. Nothing. Nola, if you're okay, say something, he shouted directly into the air holes. Still nothing. Could she have passed out? Sig stuck his fingers into the air holes. All clear. Even if they weren't, there's enough air. Sig banged the case again, harder than ever. Maybe being in a confined space. Maybe she did pass out. If she did, she'd still be okay. Unless, Zig's brain was racing now. If she accidentally turned on her side. Sig shook his head, refusing to consider it. And then he replayed the familiar image that always leapt into his brain whenever he saw a news report about a child who drowned, or a little boy who was shot by a stray bullet, or a young girl who... Sig shut his eyes, but he couldn't stop seeing it. The red siren, spinning and blinding him. He was fighting through a crowd, pushing his way to those doors, to the open back doors of an ambulance. The doors seemed so far away, and then suddenly so close, close enough to see. There, dangling from the gurney, a sagging arm. His chest turned to ice. Every parent knows their child. He knew it 10 minutes ago. But now, to see it again, to see it this close. That was his daughter's arm. Maggie's arm. Just from the color of it. The gray color. He knew all hope was gone. He was still elbowing through the crowd, fighting to get closer. No one fought against him. Except at the end, when he reached the tall black paramedic who had no hope of stopping him. And then Sig was standing over the gurney, gasping for breath, like his lungs would never hold air again. No, 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 no. Even now, Sig could hear himself sobbing, praying, pleading with God that Sig could trade and be the dead one instead. Nola! Sig shouted. Grabbing at the metal casket, undoing the nylon straps with one hand, the clasps along the side with the other. She needed air. Get her out! He flicked open the final three clasps at the foot of the case. Ka-clack, ka-clack, ka-clack. Gripping the lid of the metal case, he wedged his fingers into its seam. Sig's body swayed as the plane began moving, taxiing toward the runway. Still plenty of time to get her out. Get her help. With a yank, Sig lifted the lid and shoved it back, revealing books. Nothing but books. Confused, Sig looked over his shoulder, scanning the empty hall. He looked back at the books. There were dozens of them, fanned in a neat stack like tumbled dominoes, textbooks with titles like Modern Military Uniforms and 20th Century Military Regalia. They were from the library. The tall bookshelf right next to where all the extra caskets and transfer cases were. Mother Trucker. That's where Sig took her. When he snuck Nola back into Dover, he backed the hearse into departures, moving Nola out of the casket and into the metal transfer cases that were stored there. When Sig went out to check on the plane, she must have... Again. She did it again. Sig slammed the lid shut, kicking himself for not seeing it coming, for not seeing the big move or the small one. He should have known all along. It's the one rule of Nola. Nola doesn't change. Vrrr! The plane rumbled and shook, picking up speed as it rolled toward the runway. Sig replayed their last few hours in the motel room last night, slowly fitting each piece in place. When Nola was clicking through Houdini's watch, she found new coordinates. From there, she knew Sig's weaknesses, his guilt and sentimentality. All she had to do was ask him to team up, make him think she wanted help. That's all it took.
Nola didn't need Zig to get on the plane, or to go anywhere near Alaska. No. The only thing she wanted from Zig was to get her here, into the one place where only he could bring her, directly into Dover. And for the third time, Zig walked right into it. The rumble of the engines was deafening now, but as the wheels left the ground, and Zig was down on his knees fighting for balance, he didn't know what worried him more. That somehow the digital coordinates on the watch traced back to Dover? Or that whoever Nola was now searching for, they'd been hiding here all along. 76. There he is, a female voice called out. Master Guns rolled his eyes at his boss's favorite line. There he is, she'd say, adding a thumbs up if she really wanted to sell it. Sure enough, as Colonel Sue stepped into his office, she gave him a big thumbs up with a double pump. Sue was a politician. If she was leading with charm, bad news was coming. Before she even turned the corner, Master Guns shot out of his seat, standing at attention behind his desk, both hands at his side. Really, Francis? Sue asked, clutching her cell phone. She was always clutching her cell phone. Have I ever been that formal? Master Guns stood there, straight as a pencil. He was a Marine. Customs and courtesies still meant something. Colonel Sue was Air Force. Didn't mind breaking. So typical. At ease, okay? That make you happy? Sue asked. Just showing respect, ma'am. Sue waved him off, like they were the oldest of friends. But Master Guns didn't need to be Dover's chief investigator to know they weren't. What can I help you with, ma'am? You weren't at yesterday's stand-up, Sue said, referring to her morning senior staff meeting. You also, considering all the bodies that arrived, didn't file a report for this morning's stand-up. Just making sure you're okay. Apologies, ma'am. No offense meant. I've just been busy with the Alaska investigation. I figured, she said, adding a smile to keep things light. She took a seat opposite his desk, glancing over at the framed antique American flag on the wall. 38? She asked, counting the stars on the flag. 1876, from when they added Colorado. My home state. Master Guns took a deep breath through his nose. Ma'am, if there's something you want to talk about, I got a call this morning about the plane crash in Alaska. Mind you, I've been getting calls all week, but this one came from the White House's chief of staff. That little bug. Was his name? Galen Gibbs. Galen Gibbs. He calls me every few hours looking for details. He calls me every few minutes. Sue laughed at that, her eyes no longer on the flag. So you can imagine my surprise when Gibbs called me at 5:30 this morning and asked me when the final autopsy report would be filed. Not just for the Librarian of Congress, but for the other victims on the plane. Clifford Eddy, Rose Mackenberg, Amadeo Vaca. He wanted all of them, said they weren't filed yet. So odd, right? Our medical examiners are usually meticulous about that. Those should have been filed immediately. But they weren't. Master Guns sat there silent, his hands gripped together on his desk in a little church and steeple. Then imagine my further surprise when I asked Dr. Sinclair about the reports. And he told me he gave them to you, Francis. That you personally asked for all the victims' reports yourself. Even the one for the Librarian of Congress. Ma'am, this is my investigation. I have every right to see those reports. Then see them after he files them. You can read them online like the rest of us. I appreciate that, ma'am. So I hope you also appreciate that the way things have been going here lately, I'd rather read from the original sources than trust what gets put online. What's that supposed to mean? It means I am absolutely tired of talking in euphemisms, ma'am. We both know what you're asking. When Nola Brown's body first arrived from Alaska, that body wasn't Ms. Brown. And Clifford Eddy, Rose Mackenberg, and Amadeo Vaca, that's not who they were either, were they? You knew that from the moment those fallen were packed in, I since sent here. Now Colonel Sue was the one gripping her hands together, strangling her cell phone. Also, ma'am, when it comes to an ongoing investigation, you know I can't talk about any of my findings. Sue went to say something, stopped herself, then started again. Francis, when people hear that this is my command, they assume I'm a serious person, that there's no humor in death. But if I've learned anything at Dover, it's that this place is filled with the absurd. Dead bodies fart. When you embalm someone, their penis engorges. Some things must be laughed at. But that accusing tone in your voice? There's nothing funny about it, Francis. You hearing me on this? If you've altered a word in those reports, you're breaking the law. So you don't have a problem with our medical examiner filing false reports. Was that your idea? Or were those just orders from someone higher up the chain of command? I told you, be careful with that tone, soldier. Not a soldier, a marine. Sue rolled her eyes. Francis, spare me the bluster. You should have never taken those reports before they were sent to my office. Me? You're the one now interfering with an active investigate. There was a loud ring. Master Guns's phone. He looked down at caller ID. He knew the number. So did Colonel Sue, who was glancing at it as well. 202-406 prefix. United States Secret Service. Why are they calling you? Sue asked. Master Guns didn't answer. Ring. Pick it up, Sue said. He still didn't touch it. Ring. Francis, pick that phone up now. That's an order. Ring. Sue's arm shot out like a cobra as she pounded the button for the speakerphone. This is Colonel Agatha Sue. Who's this?
Terry O'Hara, Secret Service, a strong, determined voice said through the speaker. I'm looking for Sergeant Steranko.
The sergeant can hear you just fine. I'm his supervisor. How can we help you, Agent O'Hara?
O'Hara paused, but not for long.
Ma'am, I'm not sure if you're aware of the subject we've been tracking. We now believe that subject has breached security.
Breached it where? Sue asked.
On base, O'Hara replied. We've got a full mobilization headed your way. After you activate surveillance and heighten security, we recommend you lock it down until we locate the target.
What target?
Horatio, ma'am. We believe Horatio's now inside Dover.
From opposite sides of the desk, Colonel Sue and Master Guns looked up at each other, both of them confused. Simultaneously, they asked, "Who's Horatio?"
77. FBI Headquarters, Washington, D.C. Amy Wags was having one of those days. One of those years, actually, ever since she tweaked her back hurling down a zip line on that stupid singles cruise her sister Kim talked her into. At 38 years old, she should have known better than to listen to her sister or ride a zip line. All she had to show for it was a herniated disc, $4,500 in chiropractor bills and a tall, adjustable-height desk that took the pressure off her spine, but meant she was on her feet all day. It was barely 6 a.m., her favorite time of day when the office was quiet, when the sky was dark, the best time to think. So here Wags was, elbows on her adjustable-height desk, clicking through folder after folder, reading Dover report after Dover report, searching for the name Zig had told her this morning. Horatio. 3 days ago, when Zig first called her to trace Nola's fingerprints, Wags was doing a simple favor. But somewhere along the way, this became more than just a courtesy for a friend. From the start, this case reeked. She knew it. Covert missions happened all the time. To protect national security, the CIA would regularly mask the names of Dover victims so that agents and sources weren't revealed. But those cases had their own rhythm. Their own pattern of governmental checks and clearances. Reports were written. Files were created. None of that could be found here. And neither could any trace of Horatio, Wags realized,
running yet another search on Dover's intranet. Still nothing. For a few moments, Wags stood there, staring blankly at the only totem she kept on her desk, a Grateful Dead Dancing Bears soy candle from their reunion tour in Chicago a few years back, a present from her older sister. Growing up in rural Iowa, Wags's sister loved to color. Her brother used to love mazes. Wags, though, she loved connect the dots. Such a simple treat. From 1 to 2 to 3 to 4. Follow along and the bigger picture will emerge. It was no different today. To move a body in and out of Dover. Was that hard to pull off? Not really. Leaning back and doing that stupid stretch the chiropractor gave her, Wags could think of a dozen different ways. But the one pattern that kept repeating? In every move across the chessboard, wherever Zig went, someone was always there first. When Zig went to check on Nola's body in departures, someone had already arranged to take it. When Zig went to Nola's office, someone was already lying in wait. Wherever he moved, they always knew Zig was coming. Like someone tipped them off in advance. For the next hour, Wags ran the list of every Dover mortuary employee, checking it against the entrance records of every person who had gone in and out of Dover during the last few weeks. She checked flight manifests to see who landed there, then rechecked those same manifests to see who flew out. She even put in a request for phone records, specifically those of Colonel Sue and Master Guns, just to be safe. Then she ran all those names, cross-checking to see who had ties to Zig, to Alaska, to Nola's office at Fort Belvoir, to the Secret Service, even to the White House itself, and of course to that name, Horatio. Despite all the dots, no pattern emerged. That is, until Wags reached for the thick, padded envelope that had been sitting on the edge of her desk. There was no stamp in the corner. Hand-delivered, just like Wags asked. The bubble wrap popped as she tore open the envelope. Inside was a small black device made with mil-spec hardware. The Fang, the machine Zig used when he first scanned Nola's fingerprints. "You mind grabbing it for me?" Wags had asked yesterday, when she heard that an FBI colleague was headed to Dover for an errand. "Something wrong with its scanners?" he'd asked. "Just needs a tune-up," she'd lied. It was a Hail Mary for sure. But every day, Wags pulled biometrics from terrorist weapons and explosive devices. That was her specialty. What people leave behind. Standing at her desk, Wags spread cyanoacrylate, liquid superglue, across the smoothest part of the scanner. It attached quickly to whatever moisture residue was there. A UV pen light did the rest, revealing the one thing she was hoping for and making her feel like Sherlock Holmes with her very own magnifying glass. A fingerprint. Two of them, actually. 10 minutes later, Wags was staring at her screen, waiting on the FBI's database. Somewhere, servers whirred. Two pictures popped on screen. The first, as expected, was Zig. But the second... Wags swallowed hard. No, that's... can't be. But it was. Wags whispered his name, barely hearing her own words. Horatio's... oh, shit.
78. Dover Air Force Base, Delaware. Dino always started with the plain M&Ms. Those were his favorites. He was a purist, preferring the plain ones to peanut, and of course to those abominations with peanut butter or dark chocolate. Or that blue-wrappered disaster, the pretzel M&M. No, plain were the best. Which explained why Dino always restocked them first in the candy machine. In the moneymaker slot, third row from the top, eye level, center position. From there he added his full murderer's row of candy. Snickers, Reese's, Crunch Bars, Twix, 100 Grand Bars, Heath Bars, Original Skittles, Sour Skittles, the ultra-underrated Take 5 bar, and in the very last slot on the right, white chocolate Kit Kats. Because why have the same candy machine as everyone else? Dropping the last pack of plain M&Ms into place, Dino glanced around the break room. This early in the morning, Dover's mortuary was quiet. It wouldn't be for long. One by one, he restocked each row, tilting each chocolate bar backward, just right. If the candy leaned forward, it'd get caught in the coil, stuck in the machine. On a military base, with the tempers here, that was never good for anyone. Kneeling down to work the bottom row, he added extra granola and protein bars, the colonel's favorites, humming a song to himself. Shares, if I could turn back time. How the hell'd that get stuck in his head? With a slam and the twist of a key, Dino shut the front of the machine and, as always, gave it a test. C5. Plain M&Ms. The coil began to spin, the plastic kicker at the end of it giving the bag of M&Ms its final shove. Tunk. Reaching into the vending machine, Dino pulled out the M&Ms. It was still early, but come on. This was the best perk of being the Candyman. Actually, second best. Dino tossed back a few M&Ms, shoved the rest in his pocket, then quickly restocked the boxes onto his hand truck. That was the job. Every day, putting back what others took. Heading out into the hallway, Dino opted for the long way around, toward the executive offices of the mortuary, home of carpet walkers like accounting and human resources, who never saw bodies, but also where both Zig's and Master Guns' offices were. Zig had already